That is the Song of the Goldfinch, and you are tuned in to the Season Watch Pod. I'm Heidi Holton. Charlie Mitchell is away, no doubt, in the depths of the forest of Canada. I know Canada's a big place, but I don't know exactly where Charlie is. But no doubt when Charlie's back, we'll be getting some great stories. After all, I believe Canada is the place where they had the time with the porcupine, holding a porcupine, which has never been recommended by any means. So welcome to the Season Watch Pod, where we take a deep dive into nature. We're very excited today because we've got some great messages that were left on our speak pipe, as well as students. You're not going to want to miss the Roots and Wings School. It is one of the most delightful things you're going to hear all week long, as well as the kids that were at Long Lake Conservation Center, because it was not just nature camp, it was rock camp. So you're going to want to tune in for that. So one thing I have been blathering on and on about that is going on at my house, we do have a wood duck house this year that a mama duck has been in and comes in and out of, and I'm fascinated by the hole and how she can do it. And so I've been learning all about the jumping of when these hatchlings are ready to go. I got word that the mama duck was making the sound. It's a different sound she makes to call to her babies to jump out. Now, I don't know that I'm going to make it or be able to see the jumpers today, but here's a little bit I found from Ranger Rick on why this whole thing happens.
These baby wood ducks hatched in a nest in a hole in a tree, 30 feet up from the ground. That's high. Newborn wood ducks can't fly, so the only way for them to leave the nest is to jump.
It's so high. Whee! I did it!
A day-old wood duck can jump from heights as high as 50 feet and land safely. Baby wood ducks bounce. So the next time you're nervous or afraid, be like a baby wood duck, be brave, and take a leap.
Well, that's a little bit cheesy from Ranger Rick, but also very exciting that these baby wood ducks will be jumping. No doubt by the next time we're together on Season Watch Pod, they will be maybe in the lake. Maybe I'll be watching them with their mama. We would love to hear from you what you are seeing. You can always reach out to us via SpeakPipe. It's easy to find that at kaxc.org. Look for Season Watch and you get a link right there. Up next, we're hearing from the adventurers who are in New York Mills. And then stay tuned, a conversation from the Tuesday morning show where we're learning all about fishers, which are part of the weasel family. I, for some reason, always think that they are a bird.
This is the adventurers from Roots and Wings Forest School at Glendale St. Clark, July 15th. I saw a June bug with its head blew up. Like, I think its head blew up. I don't know why, but like, or it got chopped off.
I saw a wasp in a mud pile, and the mud was on, it was on the side of grass. The grass was on the side of the creek.
I've seen two bass swimming in the lake, in the river.
I saw a rove beetle, and its head was black, and the middle was orange, and the bottom was black, and it had little white dots on it.
I saw animals scat, and it was high in calcium. It was white, and it had fur in it. I think it was from an owl.
You think it could have been an owl pellet?
Yeah.
Okay. If it was poop, because scat would be the poop, if it was poop, what animal might it have been then?
Coyote.
I saw a little frog, like tiny, like my fingernail.
I saw blackberries, and last week we thought they were raspberries, but they weren't ripe.
I saw a bunch of sunnies swimming down the river. They were little sunnies.
We walked down the creek today, and the current was really strong. And the current pushed me into a deep hole, in a little deep part where I couldn't touch, and Leona had to pull me out.
Did you have a life jacket on?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And we found a freshwater mussel.
I found a black and white winged dragonfly flying by.
I saw a strawberry growing.
Thanks for listening. Stay wild.
It is time for another conversation in our series, Critters That Use Dead and Declining Trees in the Forest. Today, we welcome in Michael Joyce, wildlife ecologist with the Natural Resources Research Institute, NRRI. He's talking about fishers today in Minnesota forests. Also joining us is our producer, Mark Jacobs. Michael, Mark, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome.
Good morning.
So first, let's just lay out, for some reason, a fisher was something I didn't understand. The sound of the word fisher, I thought it was a bird for the longest time. What is a fisher? When I'd hear people say, I saw a fisher, I was like, oh, okay, it's a bird.
Yeah, so I'll start with a quick joke. Those of us that study fishers also tend to study martins, and we like to joke purple martins and kingfishers because I've actually shown up at nature centers to give talks to audiences that were very much expecting a presentation on birds. So fishers are one of our forest carnivores here in Minnesota, our biggest forest weasel, if you will. So imagine about the weight of a house cat, but longer and skinnier than that. They are brown. They have a longer tail than martins, dark. If you see them, they might look like a fluffy otter, so they don't have that sleek fur of an otter, but size-wise, they're somewhat similar. And they love to live in the trees, so they do a lot of climbing and some hunting, but they also do most of their hunting on the ground. But they are really associated with our forests, and they're one of the cool species we get to see and have here in Minnesota.
Most definitely cool species. I've seen a few here and there, and I caught one on one of my trail cams one day. I was thrilled to know there was one in my neighborhood. I love living in close proximity to mustelids, and they are just, all of them are fascinating. But the fisher is kind of like the king of the group outside of wolverines. And sometimes people will say to me, I saw a wolverine, and I am always skeptical, especially if they're talking about Minnesota, but maybe you could talk just a little bit about why that is.
So we also sometimes get sightings from folks that think they saw a wolverine. It generally, whenever they have photographic evidence, it turns out to be a fisher. We have probably in the last 10 years had a wolverine visit. They can move long distances. But they are, I think one of the reasons that they sometimes get confused is because we don't really see fishers a lot. And so a lot of people, you know, you see the squirrels, you see the deer, you see the rabbits. Fishers aren't one of those that you see a lot. And so when you see one, it's sort of this like, wow, what is that? And we hear that a lot from folks. So they are sort of this really interesting secretive species. I think one of the reasons they captivate our attention so much is because they're out there, they're doing their thing. And we might not know about it because they're very good at being secretive when they need to be.
What are they eating?
So I like to say, and this is true, fishers will eat anything that they can catch and fit in their mouth. That's sort of the mustelid way, if you will. A lot of what we've seen fishers eating in our studies are the things you would expect. So snowshoe hares are a really good diet item for them. They represent a good trade-off between the energy a fisher has to put in capturing that prey and that energy they get back from eating the prey. So fishers love snowshoe hares. Where they live with cottontails, they don't care that it's a cottontail. They'll eat them as well. We see them eating tree squirrels, so red squirrels, gray squirrels. I suspect they eat fox squirrels where they overlap. We haven't documented that, but that's just how it goes. They do eat smaller rodents. They will eat some fruit seasonally. And then the other one that sort of surprises folks is they eat a good amount of deer. But that's primarily almost exclusively from scavenging. So in the north, that might be a wolf-killed deer that doesn't completely get consumed. They're the cleanup crew. They'll come in and take what they can. In other parts of the state, it may be a deer that a hunter tried to harvest but couldn't recover. They might find and eat that. It could be a roadkill deer. There have been one or two that I'm aware of videos of a big male fisher capturing and killing a fawn. That's really, 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 really rare. That doesn't happen very much. And then the one that we were sort of interested in as we moved some of our work into southern Minnesota is they do like possums as well. So they're eating a lot more possums than we would have expected.
Eat more
so,
possums.
Literally. Yep, that's right. It's a good bumper sticker right there.
Yeah, it is.
Michael, you're a wildlife ecologist with NRRI. Tell us about your work there.
Yeah, so the Natural Resources Research Institute, we're part of the University of Minnesota. We are a very diverse and integrated group of researchers that are focusing on providing natural resource-based economic opportunities, but making sure we do that in a way that's sustainable and that honors and doesn't degrade those resources. So the work that I do focuses on mammals, and we really are interested in all things mammals. So we focus on the conservation, ecology, and management of mammals. We really like to drive our work based on what the research needs are. Sometimes that's information needs. Sometimes we have a species that has a decline that we need to learn a little more about so we can take steps and actions to correct that decline. So we're really interested in all kinds of things. We track a lot of animals to understand what habitat do they need, to find better ways for us to map and understand wildlife habitat, to know the role of various factors in population declines, to know how these species are responding to what we as humans are doing, both from an economic standpoint and just a day-to-day life standpoint. And some of the other things we're interested in are monitoring techniques and really seeing what species we have in the state, like fishers, that have a need for us to learn more, and then finding and asking the right questions and trying to fill those knowledge gaps.
I know that, Mark, the focus is dead and dying trees in the forest. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the association between fishers and these dead and dying trees. And then I would also like to know a little bit about your box study.
Yeah, so I'll start with the dead and dying trees. Those two things are really importantly linked. So fishers really rely on trees with cavities in them to give birth and then to care for their kids. Out of the over 1,000 reproductive dens that have been documented for fishers across North America, all of the sites that they give birth are in tree cavities. And almost all of the sites that they care for those kits until the kits are old enough to be independent are also in tree cavities. In fact, they are our biggest cavity obligate, so they need cavities, wildlife species in North America. And so as anyone that's been in the woods knows, that's not a prime healthy tree usually that has a cavity. That rot can start when the tree is still healthy. But heart rot fungi needs to get into the tree, needs to form this decay column. Sometimes a woodpecker opens it up. Sometimes it's a frost crack or a lightning scar where a branch rots out. So there's different things that open up that internal cavity. But then it's really important for fishers for that maternal care that I already talked about, so giving birth to their kits, caring for them. It's also really important when we get cold days. Not too cold, but when we get sort of our typical winter day, fall, spring, these are places that fishers go and rest. And so they provide a warm environment for them to keep warm. They also provide that protection so that if a predator comes, they're nice and secure. So all of those things are provided by tree cavities. But when we think about dead or declining trees, and before I move on, I'll just say in Minnesota, and this varies across the range, about 2/3 of the cavities that they use are actually in live trees, not in dead trees. But as a tree continues to get older and die as it has this decay, they'll continue to use it until it falls down usually. And we do see some of the aspen they've used, right? These big decay columns can provide weakness. So when we get a big windstorm, sometimes they snap off. But in some cases, the whole tree falls and now it becomes a hollow log, which is also really important for them. They'll rest in there. The only structures other than cavities that they use to help raise their kits tend to be hollow logs. And so one really important thing is that the type of decay that creates that hollow inside does not happen after the tree dies. That has to be initiated when the tree is alive. the rot and decay that happens after the tree is dead tends to be from the outside in, and it will not create a cavity. So any hollow log they're using was a hollow tree first. So in addition to this resting and denning, it also provides really important habitat for some of their prey. So we just talked about what they eat, but snowshoe hares respond positively to log piles. So that's past dead and declining trees that decline to the point that they fell over. Squirrels use tree cavities as well. So it's not just them. It also provides habitat for their prey, and in some cases, the things that they need to go and capture the prey. So I'm just going to take a quick breath here. Sorry, I talk a lot.
No, that's quite all right. I'm curious, how big of an opening does it take to get a fisher in to one of these trees?
Good question. So it depends whether you're talking about a male or a female fisher. The behavior I just described, both males and females do. But when females are looking for a place to raise their kits, they typically don't want male fishers to be able to get in. And so as long as it's about a 3x3-ish, square-ish hole, that's good enough for a female fisher to get in. Wow. If you think about like the average pileated woodpecker hole, it's oval, but it's about 3 to 3.5 by about 3. That's perfect for a female fisher. A male can't get in there. You need to get at least about 4, 4.25 inches for a male to be able to get in.
Is the limiting factor the skull size?
Yep.
I thought so.
Before we hear more about the study with NRI, we just heard from Casey in Warba. He said, when I was doing forest inventory in old hardwoods one late winter day, I had a fisher chasing a hare run within 10 feet of me. As I stood still, the fisher stopped to look at me before continuing after the hare. It was terrifying and amazing at the same time.
Yeah, that is a really special thing to see. You know, we study fishers. We've been studying them for over 10 years. We don't often get to see them other than when we're trapping and collaring them. So I consider any time you see a fisher to be a special day. It can be scary, especially, you know, we know they're a predator. We hear this a lot from folks where they're mean, they're ferocious, and they are if you're their prey. But they're really indifferent to scared of humans. So in that case, probably was assessing to make sure that that wasn't a threat before it went on its way hunting. So they have the tools that they could hurt us. But unless there's a disease or something up with the fisher, they do not approach people very readily. I mean, again, if you back one into a corner, that might be a different situation. But they want to get away. But yeah, really cool sighting.
What's the den? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, should we talk about the den box study
now? Please, yes.
Sorry, I answered the first part of that question.
Yeah.
So given their need for big trees with cavities, one thing we know is on average, if you're looking at aspen, those cavity trees that they use are 20 inches. When we do aging, it's really hard to get good cores on some of these trees. But when we do our best to age these trees, we're looking at a minimum of 80 years. So obviously, as we do economic forestry, we don't let a lot of the trees get to that point where we're harvesting. So the concern there is, well, what can we do to help promote this habitat need while also allowing for our economic forest activity? And that's where the Denbox project really came in. So we wanted to evaluate. We knew from some other studies that fishers will use artificial den boxes. Wildlife managers have seen fishers occasionally using wood duck boxes. So we wanted to know really how frequently will they use them? Does that give us any indication of whether cavities are limiting? And then is that a good management tool that we can use to provide this habitat need in younger forests while they're regenerating to help balance what us humans want out of the forest and what fishers need? So we put up about, with partners, it was about 120 den boxes across mostly Superior National Forest, Chippewa National Forest. We had a few other satellite sites, Carlton County, Cloquet Forestry Center. We put up a handful with Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. And then we monitored them really intensively. We put up cameras. We had temperature loggers. We'd visit them, make sure the cameras were running. And what we found was that over our three-year study, about 41% of the boxes were visited by a fisher. So fishers found them. They didn't choose to use every box that they found. So we got use in about 11% of the boxes. And that happened about 43 times where we had use. And it included resting, a lot of females resting. We did not have any kits being born in our boxes, but we had three or four boxes where female fishers would bring their kits as they were developing and they would keep them there for some time. It included mating. We had a few females that used our boxes to mate. So they go into the cavity. Male can't get them. That way they can decide whether or not to mate. So we saw that a few times. So in terms of fisher use, we were hoping to see more use to indicate to us that this is something that if we use this, it could work. We didn't see the type of the scale of use that we were expecting, but we think part of that is we set up this study with respect to where fishers were recently harvested and where a past study from the DNR had fishers living. And we did our best to put them in places fishers would be, but obviously you don't know if a fisher is there every time. And so we did have a number of our boxes that we never detected fishers in the area of. Where we knew there were resident fishers, we tended to get some level of visitation and use. But back Michael, to the whole, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Just discuss how many photos you had to go through in that study. It's amazing.
3.5 million.
What?
It was a lot. It was. We knew we were going to get a lot. We maybe stupidly didn't think we were going to get quite that many. So it was a huge effort. And we did the temperature loggers. We published a paper about a year ago. They actually gave us really good information to know that some of what we were seeing on camera, where we'd see a fisher outside a box, but we didn't know from the pictures that it went in. The temperature signature told us, oh yeah, no, it actually went in there and stayed there. So these two images, 8 hours apart, the fisher was there the whole time. So, you know, it was a lot of work though, especially because I think we had martens at 74% of our boxes. We had flying squirrels at 90% of our boxes, red squirrels at 88%, gray squirrels at 70%. So we joked we're going to rebrand as the squirrel nest box study. But clearly that's important for the prey that fishers rely on as well.
Yeah. It'd be awfully nice of a nest box to fill itself with flying squirrels so that the fisher could just drop in and have lunch.
Yeah, sort of dinner and lodging at that point, I think.
Yeah. So do you have concerns regarding the fisher populations and maybe is there hope?
Yeah, so one of the things that really sparked a lot of the research we've done, and I'll try to be short, I know I tend to talk a lot, is this population decline. So in the late 90s, early 2000s, we had a population of about 16 to 17,000 fishers. We're currently at about 8,000 to 10,000. So over a 20-year period, we lost about half of that population. It's gone up a little bit and stabilized. So a lot of the work we've done is focused on, like the cavity thing, what are the things that we need to think about for fishers? How can we learn more about them? Bobcats kill fishers at high rates. That's another study that we've worked on. And the reason they do that is because they use a lot of the same prey, they hunt in a lot of the same areas, and they're active at the same time. So if you're a bobcat, removing a fisher provides more access to prey, but also keeps your kitten safe when it's time for you to have young. So that's another concern. We've seen fishers move into southern Minnesota, so we've been really trying to learn a lot more about what's going on there, where we see some disease things that concern us. We see some really high rates of roadkill mortality for fishers that concerns us. We're in the process of trying to get some funding to look more into that. And then the other one that really comes up, other than the predators and some of these roadkill and disease things we've seen, is exposure to anticoagulant rodenticides. We're working on a study now where we're finding about 70% of fishers that we've sampled that are harvested by trappers have been exposed to anticoagulant rodenticides, so things that we're putting out to control rodent populations in our houses. Really important that we control those rodent populations, but sometimes what we need to do has these sort of unexpected consequences. So those are other risks that we're really hoping to learn more about in the next year or two, so we can make sure that we can do what we need to do as humans while also leaving space for fishers and other wildlife to do what they need to do.
That is Michael Joyce, wildlife ecologist from NRRI, along with Mark Jacobs. We appreciate you guys. Thanks for being here.
Wonderful program. Thanks, Michael.
This is the Season Watch Pod, a production of KEXE. We are people-powered, and we were the first rural public radio station in the nation. We began 50 years ago in 1976. We're people-powered. That means it is people like you, whether you're listening to a podcast or you are listening on the radio. You make it happen. It's not large corporations. It's your friends and neighbors, people who care about the place that we live, about the land and the happenings, like we just learned about the Fisher. You can help us out, keep us people powered with your support. Go to kaxc.org and click on donate. Up next, a few more messages that we got this week about nature sightings, phenology sightings in northern Minnesota.
Hi, this is Ella.
And Dawson from Camp Nature Rocks at Long Lake Conservation Center. July 14th through the July 18th. The temp for our camp week, we're high at a 95 degrees Fahrenheit. The low was 57 degrees. The wildfire smoke rolled in at 10 a.m. on Wednesday.
Here are observations for the week. There are a bazillion titmouse and one army worm, and dragonflies are laying their eggs on the water. We saw a blue jay, a painted turtle sunning on a log, otters swimming in the lake, a pair of common loons, several white-tailed deers, adults and lots of baby bunnies, a mom robin feeding her baby that was the same size as her, three fox kits, a Virginia tanucha moth on a common milkweed bloom, and the hawthorn beam trees are fruiting.
Hey John and Charlie, here are a few nature and music jokes for you. What's a frog's favorite type of music? Hip hop. Why do hummingbirds hum? Because they don't know the words.
We had a great week at camp, and we want to remind everyone that nature rocks. So unplug, get outside, and live connected!
This is Julia in Bemidji reporting that I am very excited that I spotted a grouse in the longer grass in my yard. Of course, I was staring, so it gave me the side eye as it turned to stroll off, ducking into cover, but kept one eye on me the whole time. They are such beautiful birds, and they vanish so quickly.
Hey guys, I'm going to send you a couple more little observations from this week that I thought were pretty cool. One, we see a lot of turkey vultures around here, so that's not unusual, and usually they're in a large swirling mass. But this week I saw two different, one was almost like a tornado or a cylinder of turkey vultures, which I thought was pretty cool. But then yesterday, driving home, there was three different waves of them that almost, they're all in straight lines, all going the same direction. At the same elevation, looked almost like B-52 bombers in a World War II movie or something out of Star Wars. The other thing I saw this week that was really cool, and that was something I always look for, are the woolly alder aphids. I saw this little tiny floating thing going across our backyard, and when it landed in the grass, I investigated, picked it up, and it was this strange, spirally white object, which was a small woolly alder aphid, as they migrate from the silver maples to, I think they look for alders, but they're one of the most bizarre little creatures you could ever investigate. Very cool to see. They're light blue with white wings, but they make this, it's almost like silly string honeydew that they use for protection and to move around, and they also, their life cycle is bizarre. You'll need to look it up. It's crazy.
Thanks for tuning in to Season Watch Pod this week. I'm Heidi Holton, and I want to thank all the folks who sent us in their nature notes. That was the Roots and Wings Forest School from New York Mills, as well as Julia from Bemidji, Chad from Little Falls. We also heard from the students who were visiting Long Lake Conservation Center. Of course, John Latimer, as well as Mark Jacobs, our producer, we learned this week about the finch from we'd like to thank Michael Joyce, a wildlife ecologist with the Natural Resources Research Institute, for helping us learn about fishers in Minnesota forests and how they use dead and declining trees in the forest, and our producer, Mark Jacobs. Be wild, get outside, live connected.